Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners go to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast, where we talk all things money and business. I'm your host, Christian Allen. With me on the other line, Rod the Pod Zabriskie. And Rod, I'm super excited today because we've got an interesting topic. And I think we're maybe breaking new ground because I couldn't find this topic anywhere in the podcast sphere.
Pioneers. Plowing a new trail.
So I'm excited about it. Most people are aware of 1031 exchanges, right?
Yeah, I would say that's true.
So maybe you can describe really quick for anybody that's, especially our listeners, they're going to know what a 1031 exchange is. But in case there's somebody that isn't crystal clear on that, give us the 1031 exchange because that'll lead us nicely into our topic for today.
Okay. Yeah, so a 1031 exchange, it's basically the tax code that tells you that if you are selling a piece of real estate and you're going to have you're seeing a profit on that, you can have a gain, that if you follow their specific rules and get into a new piece of real estate with that same money that you took out of the previous one, then you won't have a taxable event. You won't have to pay the capital gains tax or whatever tax would have been due on the sale, because now that money is into the same like for like, right?
Yep.
Real estate into real estate. As long as you do it, follow the rules, then you avoid having to pay any tax on those gains, at least at that point.
Yeah, so it's a deferral method, right? As long as we have a like kind exchange, we can defer taxes to a future period of time. And a lot of people love it because you can defer it till death and then get a step up in basis and never pay those taxes. So there's a lot of power inside of this 1031 exchange ability. And obviously, anyone who's on top of this knows that it's also under fire right now. So we'll see exactly what happens with it. But as far as I know, the topic we're going to talk about is not under that same fire. But for some people, it could be impactful in a really similar way. Okay, so without further ado, Rod, I should probably introduce the actual topic. We're going to talk about another tax code known as a 1035 exchange. Okay, so we talked about 1031 exchanges being directly related to real estate. A 1035 exchange. Oh, and by the way, I should just mention this. We have, I'm actively working on bringing in an expert in the 1031 exchange market to give us like a more, you know, like a deep dive into 1031 exchanges, because there are quite a bit of rules and things you've got to make sure you do right in order to make it work. It's not like overly complex, but there's definitely things to know. Okay, Rod, so do you just want to tell the listeners exactly what a 1035 exchange is and how it's similar to a 1031 exchange?
Yeah, exactly. So a 1035 exchange is just dealing with life insurance or annuities. There's money moving from one product to another. And so similar to the 1031 exchange, you're moving from real estate to real estate, like for like. Here, moving from one product to another. And the deal is that you don't have any kind of tax consequence as a result of doing that.
Yep, you nailed it. Okay, so we can go life insurance to life insurance. We can go life insurance to non-qualified annuity. We can go life insurance to long-term care or vice versa. However, what we cannot do is go non-qualified annuity over or qualified annuity to life insurance.
Yeah. Yeah, but you could go annuity to annuity, and that would be considered, or non-qualified, right? Non-qualified annuity to non-qualified annuity.
Yep.
That would also count as a 1035 exchange.
Yes, you nailed it. And the reason we left out anything IRA related is because once it becomes an IRA, it now is subject to the IRA transfer rules. So a little bit different there, but 1035 exchanges ultimately can be a benefit to someone in a lot of different situations. And so we wanted to make sure people are aware and understand what it is. And that way, if you're someone that fits into this equation or someone that fits into this world where this could be a benefit, or even if it could be something that's a benefit down the road, hopefully this will give you enough information to be dangerous and be able to kind of pick out the opportunities to make your situation better. Okay, so with that said, Rod, let's start by just talking about how the actual vehicles that we're going to be talking about are taxed. And we're not going to get into a deep dive on each type of product. We're just going to get into the tax part of it, and that way it can give some context as to why one would even want to defer taxes further or use a 1035 exchange. Okay, so let's start out, Rod, start out with the basics of how life insurance, permanent life insurance, is taxed.
Perfect. Okay, so I'm glad you differentiated, because in case somebody was wondering, term insurance would not fit into this conversation because it doesn't have any kind of underlying cash value associated with it, right?
Yep,
so permanent life insurance products. So this is whole life, universal life, index universal life, variable universal life. Okay, any of those cash value types of policies would apply to this. Okay, so first of all, the IRS has what they call their definition of life insurance. Okay, and any life insurance policy that fits that, the way it's taxed is after tax dollars go into the policy, it grows tax deferred, and all that means is you just don't get a 1099 at the end of each year as your account grows. As you take money out of that, you're able to take it out tax free. And then when you pass away and the death benefit pays out, that pays out income tax free as well. So think of it kind of like a Roth, in the sense that after tax dollars are going in, and then all the dollars that come out are going to be able to come back out tax free. And there's, again, we're not going to get in a ton of detail on this. There are some specific guidelines you have to follow to get all that to come back out tax-free. But just know that's, as long as the policy fits that definition of life insurance, that's the way that the taxation works.
Mm. Okay. And it's also very, if you want to think of it as similar to real estate, there's a whole bunch of similarities in how that works. So for example, when I put money into real estate, I'm building an asset, just in the same way that when I put money into life insurance, mm-hmm. I'm building an asset. And using the right tools, using the IRS guidelines, I can literally defer that money up until death. And at that point, I obviously get the step up in basis inside of a real estate situation. Well, the same thing basically applies in life insurance, because I get the step up in basis, but it's in the form of a death benefit. And so there are a whole bunch of similarities when you think about how life insurance and real estate work. And that's probably a big part of why we use them together so often, and why they can be so impactful in that way. Okay, Rod, we're not going to get into a ton of details on annuities, even though we probably know enough to bore a lot of people on it.
Yeah.
But let's just go ahead and give the basics on how annuities are taxed. And again, this is specifically a non-qualified annuity. And when I say non-qualified, it's an annuity that is not inside of an IRA, 401k, or any other type of what they call qualified plan.
Perfect. Okay. So an annuity, again, in this case, it's after-tax dollars going in, because it's non-qualified. The money grows tax-deferred. So like I said a minute ago, that just means you're not getting it taxed on, or you know, get a 1099 at the end of each year saying, hey, you got this much growth and you have to pay tax on that. None of that happens. It just grows tax deferred. Now in this one, when you start to take money out, you're going to be taxed on the growth, and the growth comes out first. So if I had $100,000 going into an annuity, and when I start taking money out, it had grown to 110,000. I take out $5,000. That $5,000 is going to be all taxable because I had experienced 10,000 of growth, and I'm taking 5,000 of that growth out, so it's going to be taxed on an ordinary income basis.
Okay, perfect. And long-term care insurance is going to be basically the same as life insurance, so we probably don't need to go into a lot of detail on that.
Yeah, and if I can just circle back real quickly on everything I just described on an annuity, mm-hmm. I was specific when I described life insurance, that if it fits that definition of life insurance, that it gets the kind of that all everything coming out tax-free. If you had a life insurance policy, that's what they call a modified endowment contract, which just means that it didn't fit the definition of life insurance. You had more money going into the policy relative to the amount of it, of insurance.
Can I just say that sounds so ironic? If you have a life insurance policy that does not fit the definition of life insurance.
If you have life insurance that's not life
exist,
insurance.
Though. Yes, but that very much does exist. Yeah. And so you have to know the difference, because they're taxed differently, right? Like you said, A MEC is what we called it. Modified endowment contract is taxed exactly like a non-qualified annuity, which is very different than a first-in, first-out situation that you get with life insurance.
Yep, exactly.
Which, by the way, because of those things, is a big reason why we teach people to use loans as the primary methodology to bring money out of the policy. And by doing that, you avoid taxes altogether.
Right.
So anyway, there's probably more details we could get into on each of them. But I think that probably is sufficient for the purposes for what we're going to be talking about today. Because I want to shift and I want to move into why someone would actually use a 1035 exchange. And I've written down a handful of examples of these things, but I want to just go through and again, try our best to come up with some of those reasons that would be compelling for someone to make that, to do that. And we want to be equally as clear about the times and situations where someone would not want to do that. Because just like any other financial decision, it has impact. And we want to know what those impacts are so that we can make decisions that ultimately help us build wealth. So with that said, Rod, I made a list of a few things, and I want to just go through kind of step by step what those are. So the first one that we have here is that we have different needs at different times. And so let's give some examples, and we'll just maybe take turns going through either one of these. But the first one is that, let's just say, for example, I bought the policy as a cash buildup, and then later I decided that I had no interest or usage for the cash, and instead I wanted to get a death benefit or a higher death benefit. So anyone who's listened to us or done due diligence in the life insurance world knows that there is a lot of flexibility in the way that agents, advisors create or design policies. And so I could design a policy, the very same product, to do one. I could do one or two or several things with that. But generally speaking, it's either built for a higher focus on cash growth, or it's focused on death benefit. So let me give an example here. I went out to North Carolina for a few months and worked with kind of a guru in the industry who'd been super successful and was kind enough to kind of let me shadow him for a few months. And he had a bunch of whole life policies that he had sold, and a lot of those people had gotten older. Now, at the same time, the company that he had been selling with had demutualized. And so he was also a little bit concerned about what that was going to mean for policyholders. So what did he do? He basically went and he met with all of the clients and better understood their specific needs, and then made recommendations as to who would benefit from using a 1035 exchange. And in many cases, we were able to drastically increase the death benefit, which in those cases was what they needed and wanted. We were able to drastically increase that at the very same price. And so in their situation, needs had changed, and therefore the design of the policy was able to change with it, but not because I could just make all of those maneuvers inside the same product. It required us to move into a new product, but we were able to get the benefit of using a 1035 exchange without tax ramifications. And then by doing that, we were able to get what they need, which again was a higher death benefit in that specific situation.
Yeah, good story. The next one we're going to talk about is similar, but on the annuity side. So annuities often are used to create guaranteed streams of income. And so, again, we won't get into all of the details on that, but let's just say someone had that, had set up an annuity where the focus was going to be on creating future income. It's still an asset. It still has an underlying account value. And so maybe as time goes on, and maybe they have other streams of income, maybe they're successful in their real estate investing, and so they don't need to worry about that income that they were planning on from the annuity, but they're getting a little more concerned about long-term care, as an example. Well, there are some fantastic long-term care products, some that fit right inside of the annuity world or life insurance kind of category. And so doing a 1035 exchange of funds from the annuity that was income-focused into a long-term care-focused product would be, again, a great use of those funds. And the benefit is that they didn't have to pay the tax on any growth that they had experienced inside of the annuity in the process of moving that money over.
Yeah, and that's one where they used the asset, an asset that was kind of a lazy asset that wasn't going to be used for income, yep. which was what the product was designed for, and now they changed it to something where they could just use it to continue to build cash, but they also had the additional benefit of being able to increase and gain or gain at all a long-term care benefit that was, you know, was more of a need for them at that time.
Right.
So yeah, that's another really good example. So another example would be when a company has just different features and benefits that accomplish goals a little bit better. So one of the options that came to my mind was when my mom, as an example, she used annuities a lot because she just didn't like, she was very risk averse, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. She was just happy to get 5% on her money and just let it grow and do its thing. And she was going to be completely happy doing that. But one of the things that happened as she kind of continued to get older, she realized that there was a lot of money that she wasn't going to be able to, or that she wasn't going to be using for any reason. She wasn't going to take it in on income. So it was really excess money. And she thought, okay, how can I leverage that money to create I'm saying a higher death benefit, but really more money that's going to my heirs, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not using it. I want to make sure that I maximize the money that can go to my heirs. And in this situation, she was not insurable at her age and health. And so one of the things we were able to do is move to an annuity that had like a 20% death benefit bonus for it. And so yeah. by doing that, she was able to maximize and get more money that was focused on death benefit. So like there's just a myriad of ways that it can be used, but Rod, why don't you hit on one more before we kind of move on?
Yeah. So inside of life insurance products in the industry, there are, you know, innovations and things and rates change. And so sometimes you may just find yourself in the product and it was maybe the best option offered at the time, but because rates change or other features inside of the products have changed in the meantime, moving into a new product is just appropriate. And so, but again, you take the value that you've already built up and you move that over. And again, number one, the tax part of it is beneficial. But another thing that we often see is that value moving into the new product sometimes just gives you a boost, gives you additional benefit that you couldn't get if you were just finding this product for the first time and starting from scratch.
Mm, yeah, good point. And we're going to talk about in a minute some of the things to avoid when we're dealing with these, yep. because there are some things you have to be thinking about. It's not as simple as, hey, I'm bored of the product I'm in. I need to make a move. Yeah. Let's see what's better. Yep. Right?
Right.
Okay. So, Rod, the next thing I wrote down is it relates specifically to cost of insurance and specifically to life insurance. But really, the issue here is that cost of insurance continues to go down and insurance companies continue to innovate. So overall today, cost structure of life insurance is drastically higher than what it once was, right?
Yep.
So because people live longer, oftentimes this works. So I'll give you another example here. Rod and I worked with an older agent who had written a whole bunch of universal life policies. And
primarily back in the 80s and early 90s, right?
Yeah, that's important. Back in the 80s and early 90s. And what was happening is because of the time frame that they had sold it, these were not guaranteed products, right? They didn't have that. It wasn't even in the repertoire at the time. So they're selling this, but they're selling it based on the interest rates of the late 80s and early 90s, which if anyone remembers that, you know, we were talking about 10 or 12%, pretty easy. It's a no-brainer. You can just get it. So even inside of a life insurance product, there, if you go in anticipating that 10 or 12% return, well, in this case, you didn't have to put that much money toward mm-hmm. it, right? Because the underlying investment was going to carry it. So, Rod, we know what happened over time. You know, as years go by and interest rates drastically change, now you're not getting, you know, 12, 10, 8. Now you're getting 3 or 4%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and then the challenge for that is that is that your policy could require more money or it could blow up. And that's, again, this is part of what gave the insurance, just the insurance industry, a bad name as a whole, because they create this product, right? This product that had good intentions, but just wasn't well thought out enough to be able to consider what could happen in the future. Anyway, long story short, Rod and I went out and helped a lot of these people who had products that were going to blow up if they lived too long. Mm-hmm. Just crazy to think about, right? And we're able to move those into, sometimes it required us to lower the death benefit, but sometimes it didn't.
Right.
That was one of the kind of cool things, because the cost of insurance had gone down over time. In many situations, we were able to get the same death benefit or more without having to increase cost.
And so
that was a really big deal.
Yeah, and because we caught it early enough in that process, there was value that was still, they had built up in that account. And by moving it over into, you alluded to this kind of guaranteed universal life concept earlier, basically all that means is that the insurance, as long as you pay your premiums the way scheduled, that even if the cash value goes to zero, the death benefit will still pay out, right? We were able to move people into those so that, again, take advantage of the cash value they already had, create hopefully the same, sometimes less death benefit, but something that was now contractually guaranteed, as opposed to what the situation they were in, where if, and in some of these it was like projecting, hey, you'll have insurance until you become 75 or 83 or, you know,
worst case
scenario for people, you know.
Yeah, that was great. So yeah, but that was a big deal, right? Being able to take the money that they had already built and do something more with it is really a significant deal. Okay, the next one I want to talk about, Rod, is a big deal. We hear it almost, well, certainly weekly, but sometimes it feels like daily. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what you have isn't always what you thought you had.
Yeah.
So let me explain. And this is a huge issue for us again. We talk to people all the time who believe that they have a policy that is structured properly to use infinite banking. We do a specialized version of that with the Investment Optimizer, but oftentimes they think that they have the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. And then find through that it's just not. And usually that happens for one of two reasons. The first reason is that they're working with someone who doesn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And I would say a lot of people have heard of infinite banking, but most people don't know how to do it well. And in fact, I'm sitting across from Rod, who I genuinely believe is as good in the industry in the illustration software as anybody at making sure policies are max funded for cash. And so what we oftentimes find is that people come to us and they're like, oh, you know, I already have this. Mm-hmm. I love my policy. It's great. And then they find that it's really not maximized in the way that it should be, and that by making a change, it could be doing much more. Now, this is a hard issue, Rod, especially for someone who's recently started doing, who's recently got into this. And this is hard for us. It gives me indigestion just thinking about it. Because what happens is, obviously, the cost of life insurance is on the front end. Yeah. So it's easier the further we get into it to be able to make that move. But let's just say that I'm 2 or 3 years into it, and then I come, you know, I get on the other side of the table from Rod, and he's like, hey, your policy is great. Or maybe he's saying, like, it's okay, but, you know, you're generating, you know, 3.8% on it, and you could have been getting 4.8% on it, mm-hmm. or 5%. Mm-hmm. And over the next 30 or 40 years, that's gonna be the difference in several hundred thousand dollars. However, to make a change might cost you $10,000 or $15,000. Like that creates, like, that's not a good feeling. But we see this kind of thing all the time. And the reason that we want to bring it to the table is because it's just so critical for people to get it right the first time.
Yeah.
Make sure you talk to the right people, experienced, people who have a track record of success, and other people can tell you about it. So that's kind of my advice as it relates to this.
Yeah. And one thing that's really surprising to people a lot that we talk to in this conversation is they'll maybe hear something about what we're talking about here. Hey, investment optimizer, this sounds great. I want to do something on this. And they'll go to their local agent and they'll say, hey, will you build me? Even if they used all the right words, like if it was coming out of my mouth, I would say, hey, build me a maximum funded, optimized to cash value life insurance policy, whole life insurance policy. And you could use the exact right words with that person. But again, if they're not living in this world and experienced in, you know, doing it, they can do what they think they are hearing you say and be completely off, just not know. And again, it's lack of experience, it's a lack of knowledge. They want to do it, right? You approach them, you say, hey, can you do this? And they're going to say, well, yes, of course I can. And then they're going to turn around and say, okay, what am I going to do? And they might even go back.
Yeah, and they'll usually go find somebody in the office that they think knows how to do it.
Yeah, and again, surprisingly, maybe even go to the home office of the life insurance company, the experts, kind of the illustration experts that they have there, and ask them. And again, I've just seen it. Unfortunately, even when they describe it exactly the way that they want it, sometimes it just doesn't come back. And I get this too. I have to know, like, sometimes when we're doing all these comparisons among the different companies, and that's what we might rely on some home office people, it's not uncommon to go back and forth with them a few times to get it right, to get the illustration to really what we're asking for. Even though, again, I'm describing it exactly what I want, sometimes it's just not the norm, right? Most agents who are working in whole life insurance just work in kind of the vanilla, plain type of variety, and that's just what they know. So,
yeah, and again, this is, so it's twofold, right? Or a couple of things to keep in mind. One, agents oftentimes either don't know, or, and this is a sad truth, or choose not to. Or maybe they choose to partially do it. We see that kind of stuff all the time where it's like partially maximized, but it's not done all the way. And oftentimes, again, that's either due to not understanding how to make the moves inside of the policy design, or it's just, again, they don't want to. And just to be very blunt, the reason that people don't want to is because the way that we design a policy creates the minimum amount of compensation per deal. Now, Rod and I aren't complaining about how much money we make, but on an every single deal basis, we make sure that the cost and our compensation is as low as it can possibly be, and that then creates as much cash as possible for the investor. And that's just super important. So we've probably beat this one, but one other thing to keep in mind, and I hit on this really quickly earlier, it's not just the agent, it's also the company. The company makes as big of a difference, maybe even more so, and right now this is especially critical. The reason it's especially critical is because we have maybe two or three companies in this space that are doing a good job, and then there is a major drop-off beyond that. So if you're not part of one of the couple top companies that are doing it, then you might as well, I shouldn't say you might as well not, you can still get value, but you're missing out potentially on significant value over a long period of time. So anyway, that's kind of my discourse on why that's so important.
Yeah, and when you say significant, I mean, it could be 25 to 50% higher IRR inside of the product. I mean,
yeah, that is hugely significant. The more money you put into it, the bigger, the more the actual dollar figures change. And so it's not uncommon for us to see situations where by choosing the wrong company over a 20, 30 year period of time, we're talking about seven figures. So, okay.
Mm, yep.
So unfortunately, what you have isn't always what you thought you had, but the good news is there are rules and regulations that give us a chance to make those changes, and that's what the 1035 exchange is all about. Okay, let's talk about some things to think about before we actually do a 1035 exchange. And the first one is that it's important to just check interest rates, right? So you have to know the underlying product, and this might be more important in, well, I say that, but obviously there's a change in life insurance interest rates right now. I was going to say this is generally speaking more important in the annuity game, because we're oftentimes comparing those rates. There's less design that's associated with them. You kind of get what the insurance company gives you in an annuity situation. Mm-hmm. And so in that world, you definitely want to make sure that if you're thinking, hey, I'm not excited about what I have here, I'm thinking of moving to something else, sometimes you'll find that the product you have will actually provide every bit the interest rate that you could get, and you're already outside your surrender schedule, which we'll get into that here in a minute. On the other hand, yeah, it certainly could be a situation where you had a guaranteed interest rate at 4.5 on a fixed annuity, and then 7 years in, it drops to 2, and that's a great time to say, hey, let's go find something a whole lot better.
So number 2 on that is about the surrender schedule. So let's just really just quickly define what that is. So this occurs in annuities. It also occurs in universal life insurance, not so much whole life, but in universal life.
Yep.
And basically what's happening is the insurance company is committing a certain amount of resources to the policy, to the account. And so if someone only keeps the account for a year and then cashes out and walks away, then the insurance company would be out a bunch of dollars, except what they'll do is they'll build in this surrender period. So and then the universal life insurance world, that's often 10 years, sometimes 15. I've seen as long as 20. In the annuity world, it's usually somewhere between 7 and 10 years. You can get as low as 5, but most often it's somewhere in the 7 to 10 year range. And basically what that means is the earlier if you were to just cash out your account and walk away, you would just walk away with less money as a percentage. So for example, let's just say it was a 10-year surrender schedule, and in year one, you were to cash out, you would walk away with, in the annuities, 10% less than what you have in your account. You have $100,000 in the account, you cash out and walk away, you're going to only walk away with $90,000 of that. In year two, it's 9%, year three, 8%, et cetera. It drops a percent each year of what that surrender penalty would be if you cash out and walk away. In the universal life space, it's even higher percentages. It might be like 50%. 40 to 50% is not common in the first year. If you put money in and you have, again, you have an account value of $100,000, that's your actual, what they call the accumulation value. But if you cash out and surrender the policy, you're only going to walk away with $50,000 to $60,000. And it goes down pretty dramatically beyond year one to year two, three, four. By the time you get to year 7, 8, 9, the difference may not be very large at all, but know what that is. When you get your statement, you'll know if you have one of these accounts, if you have two values. One value says this is your account value, and the other one says this is your surrender value, and the surrender value is something less than what your actual account value was.
Mm. Yeah, and you brought up two, I think, important points there just to emphasize. One is not related to 1035 exchanges, just know your product in general.
Yeah.
Right? Know if you're getting into a product that has a surrender schedule. And if it does, make sure that you're comfortable with it because it matches your goals. There's reasons that it can be useful and valuable and not a problem, but there's times when it can be. The other thing here is that knowing your surrender schedule is important because a 1035 exchange eliminates taxes. It does not, however, eliminate surrender charges.
Great point.
So that's directly related to the insurance company. If I do a 1035 exchange 5 years into the example that Rod said, I'd get 95% of my current value in that situation. So again, knowing your stuff on the front end is really important, but also if you're considering 1035 exchanges or it's something you're interested in looking into more, then it's important to know what your existing surrender schedule is so you can make good decisions about whether the timing is right or whether you need to wait. Anyway, you can evaluate the numbers better that way.
Yeah, and real quick on the front end, the way that you can see that is similar to what I described on your statement. If you're looking at an illustration or projection and it shows separate columns, one for the actual account value and a separate column for the surrender value, then you know there's a surrender schedule and just pay attention. At what year do those become the same number? Now you know how long your surrender schedule is going to be.
Yeah, that's a great point. So the next one is that it's important to know how much time you have to complete the transfer. And I'm speaking specifically with annuities here. and specifically an annuity that's come out of surrender. Sometimes an insurance company will give you a defined period of time outside of that surrender to move it to a new product. Otherwise, it might lock it in for another year or something like that. So it's important to know kind of what's going on with the underlying product, what your time frames are. It's not nearly as complex as dealing on the 1031 exchange when we're going into real estate, and we have very, very tight timelines, and we have to make sure we, you know, determine which properties we're going to be looking at. So that's a lot more complex from a timing standpoint. But either way, it's important to know kind of what your timeframes are so that you can get it done the best way possible.
And just kind of hearing you walk through that, I think it's also important to know that 99 out of 100 times when a 1035 exchange is done, the money moves directly from one company to the other. The individual is not going to take possession of that and then have to know what to do with it. It just goes direct. So that's another kind of benefit or just convenience as it relates to the 1035.
So one of the other things that is important to know, and this can be something that creates confusion for people, so I want to make sure it's super clear. You can change your agent without doing a 1035 exchange. So if your reason for wanting to leave a product or service is because, hey, I feel like my agent didn't do a great job, maybe you don't feel like you can trust them, maybe you just found something better and you feel like, hey, there's a better way to do this. So there's the important thing here to know is just that there's easy, really simple ways to do an agent change of record. And so don't feel like that makes sense as a primary reason to do a 1035 exchange. These other factors have to be in line. It has to make sense financially. And that one shouldn't even be a factor.
Okay. And then on this this last point, it's critical to know exactly the details of the product that you're doing the 1035 exchange into and how it compares to the one that you're coming out of. And I mean, we could give a lot of stories about situations we've seen where a recommendation was made by an agent to move, and it just didn't make any sense at all. Like Christian said earlier, when we set up these policies, even when they're optimized, even the way that we build them where they're really optimized to grow the cash value, to make it most profitable on that side, the costs are higher in the first couple of years. It's just the way it is. And so you just have to remember that. So when someone, you know, pitches you a good deal and they say, hey, this is a great idea, this is a better option than what you have, et cetera, et cetera. That's important information to know, but that by itself doesn't mean it's a good idea to do the 1035 exchange. We're always really careful anytime we look at this, not only to say, hey, this is an option. So here's usually what I'll say for people that have an existing policy and we're considering, or, you know, we're talking about kind of one of the things that we do and how it might be better. I'll basically say, here are your three options. Number one, you keep what you have, you just keep doing what you're doing. Option number two, you keep what you have, maybe we make some changes so you don't have to keep putting money into that, and we start you up a new policy to start putting money into that. And then option three is we start something new and we move what you have into that policy to give it a jump start. But we always look at those specific details of what does it mean to make that change as compared to option one or option two. And so we're really careful and methodical about that because it matters, right? The long-term goals of the individual have to align with what we're doing. And if they don't, or if they're just not as optimal by making the change, then no big deal. Keep what you have. We'll work inside of those parameters, and then we just add to it to get as close as possible to what you want as the ideal, but not cause harm in the process of doing that.
Really well said and great points. The nice thing is there are suitability reviews. So insurance companies will do these suitability reviews, but they're not perfect, right? So a cunning advisor, if they really wanted to, could likely get through the suitability reviews. So like Rod said, those three options are really the way to look at it. And if you'll go through those three options, you'll end up in a much better place where you can make the decision without any regret. So, okay, without further ado, Rod, I think we're going to call it a day. So thanks, everybody, for joining us for today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast. Leave a rating review if you like our stuff, and we will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights Podcast. To learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in this show, visit moneyinsights.net.